This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have an electrifying program for you today. There's a lot of terrific news from this past week that our panel of trumpet writers is eager and ready to discuss. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also today from our office in Britain, Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me along.
So I want to encourage you to listen to this whole program today to see just how interconnected the world really is, how much this event over here impacts that trend over there. Today there are so many events and trends playing off one another to fulfill biblical prophecy. It really is extraordinary to watch it all developing. In a lot of ways, we could enter our discussion today from any number of starting points. And as we proceed, I think you'll see how they loop around and connect with one another. But we're going to start in Germany. This is quite a picture of just how rapidly the world is changing and how much those changes are forcing even more changes. For decades after World War II, Germany lay low, apparently contrite after bringing about the most destructive wars in human history. And even to the present day, there's a general perception that Germany is pretty hesitant to use its military power. It doesn't want to resurrect the ghosts of that warmongering past. But an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly draws attention to an analysis by Carnegie Europe that says, in reality, that timidity about exercising military power isn't really holding Germany back any longer. It's really an amazing development. The significance of this is going to be immediately recognizable to anyone who's followed the trumpet for any length of time. To learn more about this, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yeah, so rather than focus on a specific event that happened this week, this article that we've got in the Trumpet Weekly titled Europe, the Not-So-Timid Leader, or that's the article in Carnegie Europe, takes a step back and says, well, actually, let's look at what has happened over the last 3 years. And it draws attention to what's really been quite a gradual process, but has added up to a very dramatic shift. So if you're just, say, paying attention to the week-by-week news events, you may well miss it. Now, in early 2014, at the at the beginning of the latest German government's term of office, they announced a whole load of changes. And so this article says, well, you know, we're coming up now towards the end of that that legislative period. These changes, they were announced at the Munich Security Conference. The Munich Security Conference this year will begin in just about a week's time. So this represents a good time to stop and take stock and see, well, how has the German military lived up to the changes that they announced? How has it changed over the last 3 years? And this author concludes that actually, Claudia Major is the name of the author, that this has changed a great deal. She writes that almost silently, Germany has changed its defense policy over the last 4 years. It talks about how they wanted to step up, and then you had the Ukraine crisis happen very quickly after that, that really forced Germany to step up diplomatically, to really take the lead as a diplomatic power, to play a leading role negotiating with Russia in organizing European nations, but then also to take a role militarily, both with their own military and then also within NATO, and just organizing NATO and playing the role here as a quote, discrete backbone of NATO. So when you take a step back, you see a lot of changes that have happened within Germany.
Now, in this Trumpet Weekly piece that we have, I thought it was very interesting the way that it drew attention to statements that the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, had made at the time when these changes began to unfold, and how we really do see what this woman is describing as the fulfillment of those things that he said a few years ago. Maybe you could just bring that dimension into the discussion.
That's right. It really is interesting that's what we try to do, to match these statements together. So she talked about the importance of those statements at the Munich Security Conference. We had I think it was a Trumpet cover article by Mr. Fleury shortly after that that drew attention to the same changes at that same time. But then he also went on to draw attention to what happened in Ukraine and about how that was going to force changes. And he wrote, you know, a large part of Germany's foreign policy shift is a direct result of Russian President Vladimir Putin's recent behavior, especially in Ukraine. So Mr. Flory had something to say along every road in that. So right from the start, he said Germany's foreign policy has just been dramatically and historically transformed. So, yeah, he was pointing to what was happening every step of the way. And now as we sit back and take stock, we can see that all of those milestones that he pointed out have indeed been major milestones.
Now, let's just get into some of the specifics in what Major talked about in this article, specific things that Berlin has done in order to increase its military presence in the world.
Right. So you see Berlin now with 12 major operations. You see a very large contingent in Mali, and Germany has really taken the lead there. And you see beyond just a military presence, also just training the forces there. So Germany leads EU missions to train Mali's police force. It also is leading a mission to train Mali's army. So a lot of engagement there. You see them training and working with the Kurds and working with various forces in Iraq. You see them get involved in Syria. You see quite a few other smaller missions. They're still very heavily involved in Kosovo. But you just see a Germany that's much quicker and more ready now to send troops, usually in the hundreds, to crisis spots. And one thing I really liked about this article is it just drew the attention to the way that crises have just been forcing this forward, and that it said overall Germany has become most active when partners or events created the necessary pressure. So you had the Ukraine crisis, you had the fight against Islamic State, you had immigration becoming a major issue within Germany, you had France attacked by terrorists. And at each of these stages, Germany has been forced to step up and forced to do more. Now you've also seen very important kind of legislative changes, changes that go on kind of in the background that aren't as visible as armies going to say to Mali, but in the long run are probably much more important. So we've seen Germany's white paper over the last summer that we drew attention to that announced some major shifts within the military. You've also seen some major changes in the way Germany interprets its constitution. If you go all the way back to the 90s, it was just about unconstitutional for the German military to deploy anywhere outside of Germany. That has been since then, over the last 25 years or so, been gradually watered down to the point that now the only real condition to Germany's deployment is that Germany has allies, not a formal collective security arrangement as it was, but it was changed a year or two ago that all Germany needs is an ally or two, and then they're allowed to deploy abroad. So there are pretty much no more restraints now on the German military deploying abroad. All of those restraints are gone. That's been a very important and very significant shift that this article draws attention to that's taken place over the last 2 years. She wrote that it has stretched the legal framework for Bundeswehr deployments, and it says within a short time frame, Berlin crossed traditional red lines, thereby moving the point of reference for military deployment. So we see a German army that in practice has deployed much more, and a German army that has really loosened the restraints that used to be on that use of military force.
It's quite an extraordinary story when you put all of these pieces together, looking at both the deployments and the changes within the legal framework for Germany to be able to do even more in the future. She also mentions just how it's increased its diplomatic and military leadership within Europe. You see a lot of nations within Europe that are more and more willing to look to Germany for leadership, and Germany willing to assume that. And it does really add up to quite the change. As you said, it's not just something that's happened in a week. It's been this inexorable building that's over a period of years along the lines of what Mr. Flory was talking about back in 2014 and long before, even back to Mr. Armstrong saying that this was going to happen years and years ago. But just an extraordinary development from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. As this is happening in Germany, we see a parallel trend happening in Asia, particularly in Russia and China. It's not just a parallel trend. It's actually a closely linked trend. These nations are positioning themselves to get the upper hand in the emerging post-American global order. We're going to look at several stories today about how active Russia is becoming. We're going to start with a story about its weapons development along with China's. And this really gives a sense of just what sort of future these Asian giants foresee and how they're preparing for that. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia and China are both developing more advanced weaponry, and along with it, they have a very visible and growing amount of determination to use that force. We've got an article in the Trumpet Weekly that includes a few excerpts from a new analysis called Threat Report 2017. And this report says the biggest game changer out of Russia is the Bukim-3 surface-to-air missile system. Russian forces now have officially received this highly advanced system. And it's a game changer because, according to this report, in modern warfare, owning the sky is everything. And the cheapest way to own the sky is to shoot down from the ground anything that tries to fly in it. And the Buk 35 is just head and shoulders above the 32 model that it's replacing in terms of its range, its speed, and its sensitivity. And the threat report says that it has the potential to change everything, and by change, we mean destroy. So it sounds a little bit sensationalist, but apparently this really is just a game-changing piece of machinery. And Stratfor senior analyst Sim Tak, he says that the Bukim-3 is already having an effect on European air forces because it basically renders any non-stealth aircraft obsolete. So it's prompting a lot of Europeans to give a lot more focus to the development of stealth aircraft than they would have given to that sort of development before. And then this report also discusses Russia's new T-14 tanks. It says that these are, quote, the world's most deadly tanks, and they're currently being field tested. The report also discusses Russia's PAC-FA fighter jets and China's J-20 and J-31 jets. It says these are a new class of stealth warplanes that are, quote, adding lines to the foreheads of Department of Defense officials in Washington, because for the first time in many years, they think there's a possibility that U.S. jets could lose in dogfights, and they're worried that these advanced new Russian and Chinese aircraft could also be able to slip past radar to bomb military bases and other vital targets. And then this Trumpet Weekly article also includes a section about China practicing preemptive missile strikes against U.S. bases in Asia. The United States maintains a whole string of bases in the Asia-Pacific region so that it can protect its allies and just project power into the region there. And there was some pretty sobering satellite imagery published this week that shows that China's preparations to preemptively strike ships and port and aircraft bunkers and things like that at these U.S. bases, these preparations are considerably further along than analysts would have previously thought. It really seems like these U.S. bases are more vulnerable than most analysts would think. So these are there's some pretty significant developments, and Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been watching these kinds of developments closely for a long time. And in one of his Key of David episodes a few months back about Russia and China and their increasingly aggressive directions, he said, "Do we realize where all this is leading? Russia and China are superpowers with all kinds of nuclear bombs and all kinds of military power. Do we realize where all this is leading? Can we look at this and believe that there has to be a great world war clash?" So I think when you consider all these developments in Russia and China and also Germany, as Richard was discussing there, you see that Mr. Fleury was exactly right. And these things all paint a pretty bleak picture of the future of global stability.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about just how active Russia in particular is being in several different countries, but you have to recognize just how much these kinds of developments concern those in Europe, and we'll talk more specifically about that. But that really had, as Richard was talking about, these world crises that are prompting Germany to step up and to take more military power, more greater military leadership. This is just one example of the kinds of problems that they're keeping their eyes on very closely. And while we're talking about military development, I just want to sneak in a story about America. This gives a sense of somewhat of the opposite trend happening here as Russia and China are developing these these weapon systems that really you know that they plan to use them. That we see something of the opposite trend in America. Now, this could change somewhat with the new presidential administration, but it does kind of show the uphill battle that the Trump-led Defense Department faces. And for this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, it's definitely always been a point of pride probably amongst Americans that the U.S., the world's largest Air Force is the U.S. Air Force. The world's second largest Air Force is the U.S. Army. The world's third largest Air Force is the U.S. Navy. And even though Russia and China sneak in there at fourth and fifth place, the U.S. Marine Corps does still make the top 10 list. But yeah, according to this this new report we've got in our Trumpet Weekly this week, those numbers aren't quite as impressive as they sound. In the fact that in least regards with the U.S. Navy, about half their planes can't actually fly. They've been have broken or ground down for some repairs that they've been grounded, and apparently the Defense Department doesn't actually have the money in the budget right now to get those repaired. And so on the one hand, you could see it's like, well, with all this Air Force power, you wouldn't it doesn't seem like that would be like a strategic threat to America. But you have to remember that's one of the definitions of a superpower is you have to be able to project power intercontinentally. And that's particularly what those U.S. Navy planes do is in conjunction with ships. They're ready to fight. They're ready to defend sea gates, defend trade lanes all the way on the other side of the world in the South China Sea and across the Indian Ocean. And so if the amount of ships that the Navy can use is actually only half of what it says on the books, you can see how, especially for like far-range foreign deployments over some of those vital stree lanes, they're definitely much closer to on par with Russia and China and some of these other Asian giants than it looks at first glance.
And this story that we have in our Trumpet Weekly makes mention not just of the planes, but also the ships facing similar kinds of problems.
Right. That's definitely been trends we've covered on this on this program before about just some of the we have these huge numbers of planes and ships that you see on the books, but then due to like technical problems or things like that, a lot of those are actually out of commission at any given time. And well, granted, I mean, the Trump administration's promising to increase defense spending and try to get a lot of those things repaired, it does put you at a vulnerable point, especially for like far range deployments. If something surprising comes up over a fight over Ukraine or Taiwan or something in the Black Sea or the Baltic Sea or the South China Sea that's thousands of miles away.
So this is something that it seems like some of the rhetoric that President Trump has put out there would indicate that he really does plan to reverse this trend and to restore the greatness of America's Air Force and its Navy and so on. However, what's interesting is to try to figure out whether he actually wants to use that power. And as you see this trend happening in the United States, you see another nation that definitely is willing to use what power it has, even though it might be fourth or fifth on the list in terms of air power. The power that it does have is being put to much greater use. We're going to, before we take a short break, we're going to return to the subject of Russia. And this is the first of a few stories that give us some more insight into just how active Russia has become in projecting its power. This morning, Brent Noctegal hosted the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. He's usually in Jerusalem. Right now, he's visiting in Edstone, England. And he explained the situation in Syria and just how Russia's involvement there has set the stage for the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, how it's kind of got ripple effects that are going through several nations. It's setting the stage for Iran's influence to be broken, as the Bible prophesies is going to happen very soon. I want to encourage you to go listen to that program or go to thetrumpet.com, watch for it. He's going to have an article there on the subject in the coming days. But I just want to give him the opportunity here, make his best effort to summarize what he spoke about in that program. Brent?
Well, I really wanted to just draw attention to two articles that came out in the mainstream media, well, in the media this week. One was from Defense News, and that one talked about how there's a coming split inside Syria between Russia and Iran, and how now that we have a situation where it looks like the Syrian regime is stabilized, and that was the purpose of Russian intervention there, as it was called for by Iran. They wanted Russia to help them to stabilize the regime. Now they have to determine who's going to be the top dog inside Syria. Is it going to be Russia or is it going to be Iran? And there was a number of stories that came out this week saying that they're not as close of allies as has been reported over the past year or so.
Okay, so let's just talk about how much. Well, first of all, what Russia did in order to what its purpose was in getting involved in that situation, and then how that has kind of changed the game in that country, and what might be happening in the time ahead.
Yeah, so Russia entered, as I said, because Iran needed help, and they provided a lot of the air power that the Iranian ground forces needed to stabilize the country in the face of rebel attacks. And once they did that...
But it wasn't just out of the goodness of the Russian heart or their love for Iranians.
No, not at all. Russia's had a longstanding relationship with Syria, going back to the Cold War days, going back to the 60s, even 70s, 80s. Russia was there before Iran was the Islamic Republic. Russia was there, and they've maintained naval bases or a naval base on the Mediterranean coast. They obviously wanted to become more dominant in the Middle East. They saw the United States retreating. This was a way that they could get in there to show up the United States, because the United States was trying to fix Syria for a number of years, couldn't do anything. So obviously Russia had their own interests at coming in. And the big question was for me when they entered, one, how does this fit in Bible prophecy? Because it's not really mentioned that they're there. And also, are they going to return home after a brief stint? Are they going to stay there longer? Now, they said they were going to return home a year ago. They haven't done that. They're still there. And I believe what they want is not just to have a stable Syria so they can maintain their bases there. I believe they want to it really increase their power throughout the globe, and that means maintaining a powerful hold on the Syrian government going forward. And that will be, well, it has to be at the expense of Iran.
Right. So we have expected Iran's influence there in Syria to be loosened. And it seems like what you're talking about here, and that's based on what the Bible says is going to happen. There's definitely going to be, from everything that we can see, there's going to be a break between Syria and Iran, which those two have been just bosom buddies for a long time. Syria really beholden to Iran, but you're looking at what appears to be a real legitimate way that alliance could be fractured.
Yeah, for sure. If you think about what happens next, does Assad stay in power, or is there a political transition away from him? We've talked about on this show how that Assad is really, and Assad's brother apparently, is Iran's man inside Syria, where Russia would rather just strong state institutions that are allied economically, militarily with Russia. They don't really care who leads. But what we've seen, even what's been reported over the past couple of weeks, is Russia kind of getting fed up with the way that Iran is dictating terms to Assad. And Russia then even... One report, and I'll have this in the article next week or next Monday, of how they might have actually fought against one another back in January, Russians against the Iranians over the fate of the leadership inside Syria. The other article I talk about talks about, mentions how that Tehran is happy with a weak leader and dominating the ground inside Syria. Russia, at least according to this article, wants to bring Syria along to become a trade partner, stabilize it completely so that it can do business with them, not only to project its power. And those two things are incompatible. Assad is so toxic as a leader that there could be no peace while he's in power, because he's already sent half his population, or killed or threatened to kill half his population. There's no way that he can continue to lead and have a stable Syria. Iran would like that. Russia doesn't want that.
Now, another factor that I think is very interesting, this will kind of factor into some of the discussion to follow, is how this all looks from Europe's capitals. As they're looking at the situation in Syria and they see what Russia is doing, and there really is, it's just yet another area where Europe is having to kind of adjust its calculations based on Russia's moves. And you know that Putin is aware of this. It just seems like he's very canny in the way that he's playing his cards. Again, we're going to talk more about this in a couple of other countries in later stories. But that whole dimension is very interesting with respect to Syria because of the prophesied alliance between Syria and Europe. So it seems like Europe's presence within Europe, or its the relationship between European capitals and Syria, is something that is somehow or other it's going to enter into this equation in a way that we're not quite seeing. But just knowing how much Europe is tuned into what Russia is doing, you'd have to imagine that Russia's moves here are playing a factor.
Right, there has to be a breaking point inside Europe where they recognize that Russia is holding so many cards over them, so much leverage on Europe, and we'll talk about this more, that I feel like it gets to a point where Europe's like, okay, we need to stop this. We need to do a deal with Russia to stop them from doing this, or we need to take something back from them. I'm not sure. Maybe Syria is that place. But right now, I mean, there's five ways that Europe can get hit across the head by Russia. We'll talk about a couple of them in the next part. And Europe has a couple on Russia, but I don't think that they're positioned as strong as they could be, or as that they're going to need to be. Yeah. To stand up to Putin.
Well, it definitely sets the table for the discussion to come. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, and coming up, we're going to continue this discussion about Russia's activities, particularly within Afghanistan and Libya, and how it's leveraging its position in these nations to do even more to put pressure on Europe. We also have another remarkable story out of Poland that shows just how much Europe is feeling this pressure from Russia and elsewhere, and it gives some clues as to how Europe is going to respond. We're going to finish with a report about how British politicians are lashing out at Donald Trump, and a whole lot more stories in our lightning round at the end. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We were just speaking about Russia and how it's using Syria as a tool for fulfilling its own national ambitions. We're going to continue this talking about a couple of stories. First, looking at just how it's getting back into a country it has quite a history with, quite a bloody history, not a very proud history, that is Afghanistan. But again, we see Russia making bold moves that reveal its ambitions. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, back in 1989, after about a decade of protracted conflict in Afghanistan, the Soviet Union had to make a humiliating retreat from there. Afghanistan is nicknamed the Graveyard of Empires because over the centuries, some powerful armies have just made some catastrophic mistakes trying to sort of conquer parts of the country or what is now that country. And ever since that humiliating Soviet retreat, the Russians have been really wary of Afghanistan and getting involved there. They've been very cautious in their approach to it. But now that seems to be rapidly changing. The Russians seem to be emboldened by all the success they're having in Syria, which Brent talked about there in the first half. They're emboldened by everything that seems to be working toward their goals in Libya, which we'll get into a little bit later. And the Russians just increasingly see themselves as the new power broker in the Middle East and in parts of Central Asia. And so they're suddenly much more confident about involvement in Afghanistan, despite that humiliation back in the 1980s. On Tuesday, Russian officials said that they're going to be hosting a conference on the future of Afghanistan a little bit later this month. A lot of big players will be represented at that meeting from Afghanistan, from China, Pakistan, Iran, and India. The U.S. is noticeably absent from that list of invited parties. And the announcement on Tuesday comes after two really big meetings last year between Russian officials and Afghan officials and some other players, too. So this announcement on Tuesday is really just the latest instance of Russia essentially hijacking the American-led operation in Afghanistan.
And that is amazing. I mean, for as much as the United States has invested in this country over, what has it been, 14 years or more, for Russia to basically say, well, we can solve this without you, that's extraordinary.
It really is. It's a landmark development. And it's also interesting because the Russians said that representatives from the Taliban would be included. You know, the Russians recognize the Taliban as a formidable player in Afghanistan, so they're including them in the conference, and that's a big departure from the way the U.S. approached the situation. Russia's trying to get sanctions removed from the Taliban. They're trying to get increased international legitimacy for the group. And we published an article in the Trumpet Weekly by our own Antony Chibadiyadwe, and I'll just read an excerpt from that article. It says, "In Afghanistan, Russia wants the status of chief broker. It is going to get it. It wants to undermine U.S. influence in the crippled nation, and it's going to accomplish that as well. And through it all, Russia is building some critical alliances." So I think it's really significant because, as you said, it shows a demise of the U.S., but it's also significant because it's just one more thing that is frightening Europe and just galvanizing and hastening Europe's unification and its military rise. The Europeans see this increased Russian involvement on all fronts, and I think we're going to start to see them counter that more.
What is Russia's real intent here? Obviously, it's undermining the United States. It's kind of a bit of a poke in the eye, but I don't know how much Donald Trump would really fight him over the right to and the privilege of being able to be involved in Afghanistan. He's probably more relieved. But for Russia to get into Afghanistan, any thoughts from any of our other Russia, Afghanistan, Middle East watchers around here?
Yeah, I would say that it's probably a number of things. I think removing American presence there is huge. It's also probably to ensure that Russia's Islamist population, there's some separation between Islamist powers and Russia's Islamist population in Chechnya and places that's been very hard for Putin to actually quell. And by stabilizing, even if it is with the Taliban, Afghanistan, I think he can cut off that potential danger, or at least lessen that.
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, I agree with what Jeremiah was saying in general about Europe being nervous about what Russia is doing. But I think there's a potential complementary interest in Afghanistan. I remember Germany has a very sizable contingent in Afghanistan. I think the mandate allows for up to a couple of thousand troops. And Britain has withdrawn from Afghanistan. A lot of other countries have withdrawn from Afghanistan. Germany hasn't. And that surprised a lot of people, just the way that they've stuck around there. And you look at, well, what are their interests here? And I think, again, just like Russia, they're not so concerned, say, about stabilizing the country or building a peace or excluding the Taliban. I think they just want a base there because it's next to Iran, mm-hmm. and it's a strong place for them to project power within the region. And so that's kind of the same thing that Russia is really kind of looking for. And as long as Russia tolerates a continued German presence there, I could see some kind of an overlap in terms of what they would like out of that region.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what type of cooperation you could see between Germany and Russia in stabilizing a country like Afghanistan. I remember an article I wrote some years back when Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg was still defense minister of Germany, where he was commenting that it was naive to think that you could impose an American-style democracy on this culture. And he said it's a tribal culture, actually almost a feudalistic culture, and that you have to be able to negotiate with the tribal chieftains, even those linked with the Taliban, if you're going to get any sort of stable order in that country. And it seems like Putin is almost of a similar mind there. He's not so concerned with turning into Afghanistan as a beacon of liberal democracy so much as he is just like, work with the tribal leaders in there to get some sort of government in place that can help us with our interest.
Yeah, very interesting. You said that was an article that you wrote. That's halfway between reading it and writing it. But there is yet another theater where Russia is making an impact. That is the very unstable northern African nation of Libya. We're going to turn there now. And for this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a place we've been watching closely just because of its instability and the fact that a lot of because of that instability, you have a lot of migrants that have used this route from Libya to get into Europe. The number of migrants is increasing. 2016 saw 160,000 migrants make that journey from Libyan waters up towards Libya, Italy, sorry, maybe hitting Malta on the way through. This was up for 138,000 the year before. And what we're seeing is Europe can't really handle that or doesn't want to handle that. So they're trying to stabilize the Libyan situation. They've been trying to do this for a number of years. But to make things a little bit more interesting, Russia has decided that they're going to enter that arena as well and look to kind of bolster the rival governmental leader than the one that Europe has been working with. So what we're – of late, it's been the – well, this man's known as Khalifa Haftar or Haftar. He is a general that works for the National Army, which works out of the eastern part of Libya. And he's an anti-Islamist. He's been the most effective fighting force against Islamic State and then also against other Islamists. So somebody that you'd think Putin would want to work with, a strong man, a warlord, but a strong man, and might be able to bring stability to Libya. So he's been supporting him. We saw him aboard one of the Russian aircraft carrier as it retreated from Syria or went back to Russia from Syria back in January. Haftar has been sending his injured, wounded Libyan soldiers to Russia for medical aid as well. And the big question is, or what Europe is wondering is, are we going to have to work with Russia to try and bring stability to Libya, or are we going to have to try to counter Russian influence inside Libya? That's a question that they're going to have to answer.
Yeah. So this individual, this really puts Europe in an interesting spot, doesn't it? For Russia to be supporting this guy. This is really going directly against what Europe has been trying to build there for quite some time. How does Europe respond to this?
Well, what we saw over the weekend, conference in Malta that was kind of dedicated. Well, one of the reasons for it was talking about Libya because Malta's on the front lines there, the island between Italy and Libya or Tunisia. And they kind of wanted to figure out, well, what do we do here? And at the end of it, they signed some type of agreement. They said they were going to send $200 million down to the Western-backed government in Western Libya, and they're going to try and train some of their navy to stop the migrants. They're going to try and set up some institutions or even refugee camps possibly inside Libya to stop migrants there. But you also saw a bit of dissent within the EU ranks as well, with some nations saying, well, Russia's a factor now. I think we should admit that and maybe approach Russia saying that maybe we can work together here.
Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, the problem is, and this is where Europe is very divided, because you've got countries like Italy and Malta where immigration is just this huge pressing concern. And it's, well, we don't care who you work with. Let's just get this sorted. And if we have to talk to Putin, yeah, that's fine. That guy's – that's okay. We can work with him. And I believe France is already – working with him and has been for a while, even while the EU kind of backs the other side. So there's a split there. But then you look at, say, Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, who don't really care about the migrant crisis. That doesn't affect them at all. But they're terrified of Russia. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, we have to contain Russia. We have to make sure that we don't let Russia get a foothold in the Mediterranean. You know, we have to oppose Russia's guy. And so it's very hard for them to do anything, and that's why really about the only thing they can ever decide to do is just to throw money at the project and never really like a vast amount of money, but throw some money at it and hope it gets better. And that's basically been the EU's approach so far.
And you have to think that Vladimir Putin just loves how divided Europe is over this.
Yeah, I think he's got when you think about powerful nations led by powerful men, there aren't many around right now. Europe doesn't have a singular leader to mobilize opinion and to ensure that it has a singular policy. Putin, it's easy for him. I don't think there's been ever a time where with a limited budget, a limited army, you can affect so much change in the world, because America's not willing to. The Asian powers are over in Asia, and he can have free reign through the southern Mediterranean and through the Middle East, because who else is there? So he's like, well, this could be a problem for Europe, migrants from Libya traveling up into Europe. How about I get involved? And now Europe has to work with me if they want a solution. Just another another bit of leverage that I can create against Europe.
Yeah, well, this article that you put up on thetrumpet.com, Putin's power play for Libya, you're talking here about just how he can almost control the spigot depending on where he throws his support, that would either choke off the flow of migrants from Libya into Europe or just open the floodgates and create a serious, serious problem. It gives him a whole lot of leverage.
Yeah, it certainly does. Same thing that we saw over in a year earlier with Turkey. Turkey, you know, what we had was Europe and Germany doing a deal with Turkey to try and stop the migrants coming in. Now it looks like Russia is going to be able to fill that role inside Libya. So do they do a deal with Russia?
I think that could well be one of the big things to watch for over this year there for Ukraine. And there's a lot of options. And I think one of the interesting things is that the German head of the UN mission in Libya, he has not voiced much opposition. You know, he's open.
He's been quite positive.
Uniquely positive, right, compared to what a lot of other people in Europe are saying. And I think he is an impressive man, that individual. I can't remember. I think it's Cobbler.
Yeah.
He led about the only effective UN intervention ever in the Congo. And now he's in Libya. But anyway, the fact that I think that Germany's open to working with Russia there shows that you're getting some openness to a deal. And if Donald Trump draws closer to Russia, if you potentially have a new chancellor at the end of 2017, you could see some big changes on that front.
So many factors at play here. It's a very, very interesting to see the way this is being set up for, as you said, the possibility for massive changes there. And really, you're talking about their willingness to work with Russia. And at this point, what choice do they have? There's just not a whole lot of options for Germany. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. And we started the program by talking about Germany stepping up its military power and being willing to take on more responsibility, changing its laws to enable more military engagements. You can see, based on all the other stories that we've been talking about today, some of the pressures that are creating this impetus for Germany to make those moves. We're going to circle back to this story now. There's a story out of Poland that shows how much Europe is feeling this pressure and give some clues to how it will respond. For this, we're going to go back to Richard.
Yes, just about the most influential politician in Poland this week. He said that the EU should be a... He said that Poland would welcome an EU nuclear superpower, which that's quite a really eye-popping quote there.
Yeah.
But Angela Merkel was visiting Poland this week. This politician was Jarosław Kaczyński. Probably butchered that. But anyway, he's the leader of Poland's ruling party. He doesn't hold an official government office, but... You know, he has in the past, and he's really kind of seen as the power behind the throne, so much so that Angela Merkel had a visit with him, as well as with people like the Polish prime minister and other more formal government officials. And he talked about how the EU needs to be prepared for huge expenditure, and you know, basically just calling for this massively powerful Europe. And I think what's interesting is people kind of talk about Poland, and especially this particular Polish party, as being the Eurosceptic, as being, you know, they want less power for Europe. And in quite a few senses, that is true. You know, they want less power with Brussels. They want more power to go back to the member states, except for when it comes to the military. And they want Europe to be a nuclear superpower when it comes to the military. They want huge expenditures on the military because they fear Russia. And again, this particular politician, he's typically been, as Reuters put it, deeply distrustful of Germany. He's tend to be one of the most Germanophobic of Poland's politicians. He has basically said that before that, Germany's trying to dominate Poland. They're reaching the point now that Poland is this nervous and scared about Russia, what Russia is doing, that they're saying, well, forget that. We just need Europe to be a nuclear superpower now.
So this is particularly interesting coming from Poland. I'm just reminded of the statement. I think it was the Polish president who said, I'm actually becoming more nervous about
foreign minister.
Maybe what was the statement he made? More nervous about Germany not stepping up than stepping up.
Yeah, that was Sikorsky. I'm just trying to remember the exact statement, but it was something along the lines, I'm more afraid of German inaction than I am of German power.
And this is coming from Poland, and he made that statement that this is the last thing. I'm probably the first Polish politician to say this in some time, but maybe just give us a little bit of a background as to how extraordinary this is, hearing this coming from a Polish politician in particular.
Right. I mean, they have a history there of being invaded by Germany, of even way before that, being divided up between Prussia and Austria and Russia. So there is a history of suspicion there. But I guess when it comes down to it, you see the threat by Russia, you can certainly sympathize with why they look at a German-led European Union. I mean, they don't want it to be led by Germany. I think they know that they're risking that, but you can see why they would see that as the lesser of two evils. And in some ways, it's probably safest for them to call for a nuclear umbrella, because no matter what that history of violence between Germany and Poland, I think they can be quite sure that Germany's not going to nuke them just because of their close geographical proximity. If Germany nuked Warsaw, they'd be shooting themselves in the foot. So they're probably more safe on that front than from land invasion. But having said that, there are more practical steps here. I mean, this is something we don't have yet in the Trumpet Weekly because it's just been emerging over the last day or so. But there are some important steps now coming to where the German army is becoming a, quote, anchor army for Eastern Europe, for like Romania and the Czech Republic. And they're kind of getting ready to merge their military forces around Germany. So you're seeing from this whole area a lot of calls, but then also some concrete steps now where they're looking for a European and ultimately a German defense.
And all of this is happening as you have calls within Germany for their own nuclear umbrella. And you get these calls from the outside, and it just increases the pressure on Germany, or increases the likelihood of this actually happening. And Europe as a whole, even the whole military project that we've been talking about, a unified military project, for it to become a nuclear power would be quite an extraordinary development.
That's right. Yeah. And that if I could just add quickly on that nuclear debate. I mean, I've been amazed just how quickly that nuclear debate has blown up within Germany, in that, I mean, maybe you saw one or two articles a year over the last 5 years ago talking about maybe Germany having a nuclear weapon. Then you had Donald Trump, and it was maybe one or two articles a month. Now we're reaching the point that it seems like it's one or two articles a week saying we need to have a real we really need to consider Germany becoming a nuclear power. Now, I've not really seen anyone say at the very top of a political party saying that. But this debate has kind of come from nowhere, and from even Germany talking about sending back American nuclear weapons, they've closed down their nuclear power plants. It's kind of gone from being very anti-nuclear to seeing this discussion in a remarkably quick time, even to the point that we had an article last week on this nuclear discussion going on in Germany, and already it's quite significantly outdated.
Thank you for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We've got one more quick story before we conclude this segment. We're going to step away from all of the information showing these interactions of Russia and China and Germany, Europe, the Middle East. And we're going to just look at the relationship between Britain and the new American presidential administration. We've been talking about just how there's this kind of renaissance happening between the United States and Britain. Well, this week, something happened in Britain that showed that it's not all sunshine and flowers and roses. Andrew Miller for this story.
There's definitely been a lot written in a number of news sources over the past week of the renaissance between President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Theresa May, even comparing them to the new Reagan and Thatcher. That comparison may be a little bit of an exaggeration, but there does seem to be a high level of cooperation between at least the two heads of state for the heads of government for Britain, head of state for America, between the two countries. But as you said, you're wondering just exactly how deep the relationship between the two countries goes, and the fact that just like America, there's a lot of division in Britain. Coming out this week that the leader of the British Parliament, Bercow, had made a statement that Donald Trump isn't actually welcome to address Parliament if he comes on a state visit to England due to his racism and sexism. Mm-hmm. And there's still some questions over whether he actually has enough authority to actually prevent him from addressing Parliament. But they have had over 2 million people in Britain sign a petition saying that they don't like him, and they even had had some demonstrations there this week against the idea that he would address the parliament there, which as we have this article by Richard Palmer in our Trumpet Weekly this week, is ironic due to the fact that the president of Indonesia and emir of Kuwait and Chinese President Xi Jinping have all addressed parliament within recent months, who would definitely have a much higher history of human rights abuses and racism and sexism than Donald Trump would have.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to cut it off there. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. You can visit us online at thetrumpet.com. We would love to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. We'll send it to your email inbox every Friday. You'll get all of the best stories from around the world for the week. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
We will finish now with our lightning round. We'll take a last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this past week, starting with Andrew.
The United States Senate confirmed Senator Jeff Sessions as the new Attorney General on Wednesday. It was a really, I think, even historically long, protracted battle to get his confirmation, with a very close vote of 52 senators voting for, with 47 opposed against. President Trump's already signed a number of executive orders on the ways that Mr. Sessions is going to help him on his crackdown on crime in America.
And we'll go now to Brent.
Today is Iran's anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and to celebrate that, hundreds of thousands of Iranians took to the streets of Tehran, shouting, of course, death to America and death to Israel. The ceremony was also rife with anti-U.S. and anti-Israeli sentiment, and some people carried pictures of Mr. Trump, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and British Prime Minister Theresa May, captioned "Death to the Devil Triangle." There was some positive news for America from Iran, though. Many of the Iranians expressed their thanks to the courts of America for stopping the ban against Muslim migrants coming to the United States.
There you go. And we'll turn now to Jeremiah.
The Prime Minister of Cambodia has banned the raising of the Taiwanese flag in his country. China, of course, views Taiwan as a breakaway Chinese province that's destined to come under the rule of Beijing. And the Cambodian Prime Minister said he welcomes business from Taiwanese investors, but his respect for Beijing means Cambodia must recognize Taiwan as a province of China. So it's really just a pretty sobering act of Cambodian submission to China's will.
And Richard.
We mentioned already the EU leaders summit in Malta last Friday. One other thing, apart from Libya, that cropped up there was quite a few statements saying that there would be what's called a multi-speed EU. This is where you would have a core group of EU nations move quickly towards unity, leaving the ones that aren't so keen behind. Angela Merkel talked about this. Then Europe has a major summit coming up in Rome on March 25th. And in kind of proposals ahead of that, the French president, François Hollande, talked about that. The leaders of Belgium, the Netherlands and Luxembourg, the Benelux countries, put together a combined report where they talked about the same thing. So you're seeing this idea of an EU shrinking down to a core group that really pushes forward, gaining a lot of traction right now. And this is something that the trumpet has been watching for a long, long time.
I always like hearing you say François Hollande. It's great. And we'll finish shorter lightning round today. We'll finish with Andrew Miller.
Queen Elizabeth II on Monday became the first British monarch to reach a sapphire jubilee, marking 65 years on the throne. The occasion was celebrated with gun salutes in London. At 90 years old, Queen Elizabeth has broken records for being Britain's oldest monarch, Britain's longest reigning monarch, as well as the longest reigning monarch currently on the world scene today.
All right, we end with a happy story. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com, and we'll give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories that we've talked about on the program today and a whole lot more are in this week's edition. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks, gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be with you.
You're welcome.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of William Wallace Everts. Spare moments are the gold dust of time. The poet has graphically said, sands make the mountains, months make the year. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.